The Social Cultural Challenges Faced by the Present Generation was presented by Wes Hurd on October 19, 2007, at the 2007 Oktoberfest, entitled Reading Minds, Dialogues Between Two Generations. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
First of all, I want to start with a question. Jack, how did you do that? 3 pages? My name is Wes Hurd, and I'm going to give a talk that follows Jack, and you'll see some common ground between what Jack is outlining. And there's a certain sense in which, if you think about what each of us did tonight, or what I'm about to do, as being each of us painting a picture in sort of big, broad strokes. He did it in his style, now I'm going to do it in my style. And the point, from my perspective, the point is to try to present a backdrop, to present a setting for the discussions and the dialogue that will happen tomorrow. So hopefully the things that he said and outlined, some of them very specifically and very wonderfully, and the things that I say, you will be able to tether the ideas and points and things that are raised by the young people who present tomorrow to some of those ideas. So I'm going to present a cultural and intellectual characteristic for the present generation. And it strikes me that this is a bit ironic and risky for me. Ironic because I'm the oldest codger on the staff and faculty at Gutenberg and the Study Center. And risky because I'm the oldest codger here, so I stand the furthest chronologically from this present generation among my colleagues. But my excuse then will be that my age, it's just my age, and I don't get it. And I'm counting on my younger brothers and sisters and student friends to straighten me out tomorrow. I straighten you out. Help us all straighten out. Jack and I both are laying out thoughts about the intellectual and psychological and cultural backdrop to two generations. We aren't taking a lot of time to be very detailed or elaborate this evening. The purpose or method in our madness is to sketch, as I mentioned, these big strokes, what I'm calling the cultural weather of this generation. If you think about it as a landscape, the terrain, the horizon, the weather in which this topic of this conversation is happening tonight and tomorrow, and the conversation that's going on in this generation, the present generation. If I were pressed into making a sweeping generalization, overgeneralized statement about the world of this generation, it would be that they are a generation of contenders with and survivors of radical uncertainty. The darkness they feel is the radical ambiguity and ambivalence and uncertainty of knowledge and perceiving and understanding the world that pervades their world. And it's a world that they're inheriting from us, from our generation. And I am taking a very empathetic and sympathetic view of where they are. I think if I were their age today, I would be no different than they are. Each generation, each culture deals with a set of cultural, intellectual, spiritual conditions that form that weather, and we all have to come to terms with it. And it's twofold. It's what we learn from and become ourselves within, and it's also that culture that threatens us. We just finished reading Dante's the first book of the Commedia, the Divine Comedy, and in the Canto 10 of the Inferno, the two principal characters, Virgil and Dante, the character, have reached a certain region of hell, and they're having another poignant conversation with those who, these people, these persons, these individuals who have been condemned and are there in front of them. And the circumstance of these victims, if not victims, but those who have been condemned, these sinners, is that they their condemnation is that they cannot know the present. They can only know the future and they can know the past. So all the information they get about the present has to be told them by visitors or people around them. And that's part of their punishment, part of their punishment. And someone I was reading recently suggested that's a great picture of where the world is today, in the cultural, intellectual setting that we're in today, that, well, for these, there's a comment that's made that when, in the dialogue, where there is no future, in the conversation they're having, that Dante is having with these people, where there is no future, knowledge becomes worthless. Their present knowledge is useless to them. And there's a certain poignant picture there. It's as if we think about it as a metaphor or analogy for where I think we are today, increasingly, it is that when the possibility of a future, as you look to the future, you conceptualize a future, where is this all going? When that picture of the future becomes remote, vague, deeply uncertain, knowledge closes down. Knowledge becomes pointless. Knowledge becomes worthless. And what emerges is a kind of pervasive cultural malaise of pessimism, degrees of pessimism, degrees of hopelessness, degrees of a felt powerlessness. Even anger, a kind of depression settles in when there is no future. Knowledge that holds open the possibility of light for a future, the way knowledge has been looked at in the West, in Western civilization, when that light that seems to be inherent in the possibilities of knowing something and being able to do something with it and shape the future gives a hope, when that knowledge dims, the idea and usefulness and purpose of knowing shrinks and becomes vague, and a darkness settles in. Now, it's worth noting, as Jack mentioned, that there's a continuity from the 60s. He was showing on his chart how certain things, seeds were planted in the 60s that are now coming to fruition. There are things that were true in the 60s, problems of technology that were emerging then, problems of knowledge that were beginning to emerge then, problems in, as he mentioned, marriage, family, sexuality. The problems and views that were embedded in, that are embedded in the present generation find their seeds, I think, in my generation. So the revolution has failed. Its ideals are dead. The belief in revolution is a ghost in the past. What has killed the revolution? for this generation? Why is it not part of their vocabulary? I think it's because of a set of perceived and real failures in our culture. They're perceived in the sense that they feel them very deeply, and they're real. Sometimes they're very complex and sophisticated and difficult to figure out exactly what shape these failures have taken and why it's delivering such an impact of angst and why. And we, it's this sense of incapacitation. But this generation is coming to terms with, it seems to me, what they see is a very dark and closed future. This closed, very uncertain future is a consequence of a series of these failures. And these failures touch and relate to the very core of our deepest intuitions about what it means to be authentically human. So let me suggest, in very broad expressionist strokes, what I think some of these salient features, what these big features are. What are the failures? First of all, I'm suggesting a failure in philosophy, part one. The failure of philosophy and its optimistic quest for truth. Put simply, if 2,500 years of Western philosophy invested its great tradition and energy on empirically and rationally identifying what is true, valuable, and good, recent philosophy has given up on that quest. The search for the truth, or for truth with a capital T, in philosophy is analogous to the quest for the mythical Holy Grail, and it has been demonstrated to be a false quest. It is deeply felt that philosophy leads to a dead-end confusion of language, terminology, and ideological power. I'll say a few more things about this in my philosophy part two, failure. This leads then to a perceived failure of authorities for knowledge and values, and this leads to a failure of trust. What is real? What can be counted on? What will not ultimately fade to failure? The failure of the Enlightenment vision, or the modernist vision, that much of the energy and magnificence, if you will, of Western civilization has been built upon. The vision that widespread, free, liberal education will liberate us from the powers of superstition, of darkness, and oppression. And they see and they feel the failure of that. And the witness, there are witnesses to this. For example, the witness that the educated and avid connoisseurs of Goethe, Bach, and Mozart cultivated their high aesthetic sensibilities within a few city blocks of the Nazi death camps. Perhaps the icon, it was suggested by one I read, perhaps the icon of the 20th century is a grove of trees beloved of Goethe, growing within the fence a few score feet from the ovens of a Nazi death camp. The failure, there's been a failure of rational, technical power and the promise of progress. When in the 60s, there was a sense, and certainly in the 50s, but even in the 60s, there was, although it was growing dim, there was still a sense of technology and science presenting a future to us. There were some seeds of hope in it. Think of all the energy that was placed into first circling the globe and then placing human beings on the moon. And all the energy and hope and vision, human vision that went into that. Well, that picture of the prowess and power of technology has faded. That reasoned conclusions can lead to an improvement in the human condition. The 60s reacted to that too, but they still had some remnant of hope and energy that it could be fixed. Thus the revolution was required. Rational technical competence, it was believed, produces, and it still does in a sense, rational technical competence produces the thrill of control and progress. But it's beginning to feel inauthentic and artificial, and ultimately dehumanizing. I think this generation feels that, forcefully. The present generation sees no evidence that the previous generation's quasi-rejection of technicism, that it has produced a mode of human living and being that is freed from the dictates of efficiency, reproducibility, making things into components and units and the machine, all of that, that whole mindset of technicism. I think they have grown a great allergy to that, even though at another whole level, all the gadgets and communicative power and things that are becoming available operate very powerfully in our lives. Cell phones and, you know, the whole bit. So there's kind of an ambivalence there. But in general, my sense is that this generation sees no particular hope, big human hope in that, the continuation of that prowess. There's been a failure to ethically control liberal consumerist capitalism. There has been a failure to infuse into this free market a deep element of human concern. It's all boiled down to making the money. And there's a failure of moral and ethical values that is generated from the 50s and 60s to where we are today. A failure to overcome or keep in check, at least, the emergence of a non-morally grounded free enterprise and liberal capitalism, which leads to, in their sense, no even need to borrow Marx for this, the commodification of everything. Everything can be bought and sold. Everything. There's been a failure of words. And what I mean by that is that there's been a failure of words and language as over against the lure and power and seduction of images. The power of the visual over the power of words and thought, in a sense. The character of thought that's generated by images, we're only beginning to explore, especially moving images in video and film. But there's a sense in which words, 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 blah, 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 are ultimately meaningless. It's connected to that idea that knowledge is failing, that our knowledge is going nowhere. It doesn't produce anything for us. Now, I'm going to say something a little bit more about this later in reference to postmodernism or post-structuralism. But just to make the point that there's a certain sense in which there is a culture that is emerging, that our generation, this generation lives in, that is outside, if you will, of the word. It's outside of language. Philosophy Part 2. Now, for the next bit, and the bulk of my next few minutes, I'm actually going to try to outline the best way that I'm capable a simple characterization of this, what has become known as postmodernism. Now, what I'm trying to do here, this is Failure of Philosophy Part 2, is to talk about the set of ideas and beliefs that have pretty much captured or been at least been highly, highly, highly influencing the academy and higher education, which this generation has absorbed both in the academy, in their higher education, and I would argue at the street level, in the media, television, MTV, music, etc. Now, am I saying that all that stuff is bad? No, I'm not. In fact, I'm beginning to think about some ideas that are very challenging to me about how all this media, this images, moving in a sense, the transition from being a word-based culture to an image-based culture is actually, it's not only an interesting challenge, but does it actually contain features within it that keep the door open for knowledge? It's another whole topic, and I don't have much to say about it right now anyway. The Failure of Philosophy Part 2, then, is about postmodernism, and this is going to get a little bit dense, so I don't mean it to be dense, but hang with me, because I think there are features of it that you will find, if you come tomorrow, in the comments and remarks that are made by our presenters, our young presenters tomorrow, I think you'll see features of it. And my point is not that you capture the individual discrete elements of these features of what I'm outlines of postmodernism, this description of postmodernism, but rather to, again, paint a big picture, a general picture, and let the general picture have its impact in your thinking. So, due to the pervasive impact of what's called postmodernism or post-structuralism, and there's another little part of this that become very, very powerful, post-colonialism. Don't have time to go into that kind of stuff. There's been a sweeping impact at all kinds of levels in the assumptions of the mind of this generation and the way they're interacting with reality. Here are the seminal elements of postmodernism as I see it. Jack has already mentioned this. The quest for truth is a lost cause. It is a search for a holy grail that does not exist. It never did exist. Postmodernists argue that objective, universal, knowable truth is mythical. We never had access to the truth. All we have ever found in our agonizing search for the truth are truths, little truths, that were compelling only in their time and in their culture. But true truth has never, ever been ours. Furthermore, we make the mistake of claiming to know the truth if we make the claim of making to know the truth. We are deluded at best, and we are dangerous at worst. Secondly, a person's sense of identity, of being an individual person, of being a self, is a mythical construct. It's a construct and a myth. The sense of a person's self and identity is actually, according to the postmodern thought and post-structuralist thought, is a composite. The sense of a self is a composite of constructed by forces of the surrounding culture. Individual consciousness, my sense of myself, a vague collection of unconscious and conscious beliefs, knowledge, and intuitions about myself and the world, is malleable and arrived at through an interaction with the surrounding culture. Postmodernism, then, in stark contrast to modernism, is about the dissolving of the self. It's about a questioning of the self. It's a dismantling of the sense of the, especially the existential self. the one, that sense of a centered being who out of it makes clear, free human choices, as we have traditionally thought about what that would look like and what that would mean. From the postmodernist perspective, we should not think of ourselves as unique, unified, self-conscious, or autonomous persons. The languages of our culture, the verbal and visual signs we use to represent the world to ourselves, literally, those are used to construct what we think of as real in everyday existence. In this sense, reality, if you will, is a text or a composite of texts. And these texts, rather than the God-created reality, are the only reality we can know. They're arbitrary, they float, they move from culture to culture, they're going to be different, creating different cognitive styles. So even our sense of ourself, who we are and how we think about ourselves, is ultimately, or how we interpret the world, how we give ourselves meaning in the world. All of this is subjectively constructed through the use of language. And this language simply floats and is arbitrary. Another element of postmodernism, the reality is created by those who have power. There's a great deal of focus on who gets power. One of postmodernism's preeminent theorists, Michel Foucault, combines the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche's ideas about how those in power shape the world with a theory of how language is the primary tool for culture making. So you have language and those who have power. Those who have power control the language, and thus they get to create the reality, the determining reality around us. What is taken for real, what is taken for true, and what is taken for granted. Foucault argues that whoever dominates or controls the official use of language in a society or a culture holds the key to social and political power. Think, for example, of how official political spin control of specific words and phrases can alter the public perception of political decisions, policies, and events. For example, this just popped into my head today when I was looking this over, is the idea of collateral damage. How that completely neutralizes what's really going on. The use of language neuters the impact of what's actually happening. People are being slaughtered as a side effect of a military event. But that's just an example of how language can be used to neuter things, and we could give other examples. Therefore, we must neutralize the political power inherent in language by deconstructing it. In other words, we can counteract those who are in power and who control language by simply looking at the language they've used and deconstructing it and finding between the cracks and the lines where they have inserted their own interests. Jacques Derrida, another postmodern theorist, very influential, suggests that language we use when we make statements, whenever we make statements, it always creates a set of opposite beliefs, or what he calls a binary. So one of the binary, one of which is privileged and the other which is marginalized. The privileged belief is always favored. For example, if one says, "Honey is better for you than white sugar," Dick, this statement of opinion has privileged honey over white sugar. In the arena of morals, one might say, to continue, sex should only happen in marriage. The opposite inference, then, is that sex out of wedlock is marginalized. If this is privileged, then sex out of marriage or variant sex or deviant sexual practices and habits are marginalized. They're pushed out of power. So Derrida argues that all language is made up of these binaries and that they're always socially and politically loaded. All language is socially and politically loaded. Deconstruction is the practice of identifying these loaded binaries and reconstructing them or viewing them differently such that that end of the binary that was marginalized, the other, that becomes looked at and privileged in a sense. That way we balance out power. We don't give power to any particular person. So what's happening here is that at the end of this, the impact of this set of ideas or this set of beliefs as they are generally applied and generally embraced, especially in the university and the academy, is that you have a plausibility, an environment where a set of beliefs are very, very critical and seriously question the environment, floating in the environment, is a serious questioning of the self, of knowledge, and of the means to knowledge. So, if knowledge, for what it's worth, is collapsing, that leads to a deep distrust of any and all who have power. Power is automatically questioned. Authority is automatically questioned. There's a heightening interest in the marginal, the unprivileged, the mundane, or the banal. A lot of the subject matter of film and media and music has been addressing this question of how do we privilege the unprivileged? How do we look at power? How can we question authority? And the concept of the hero, interestingly enough, I got my little bullet point off there. The questioning of the hero is redefined. So we get the revenge of the nerd. And the outsider is a hero. In general, the other is empowered to defy the powerful. Let me make a few closing remarks here. All this points toward an enveloping malaise. In the late 20th century and early 21st century, in this generation. And the malaise is that there is there's a sense in which, on the one hand, there's an explosively fueled, hyperspeed, economic, technical dynamism at work in multinational corporations and powerful uses of vast amounts of money to control even nation states. And that is coupled to a perceived failure at the very core of knowledge itself. And this has been responded to, in my view, by the present generation, with a sense of helplessness, a great temptation to helplessness, a great temptation to a sense of inactivity, of passiveness, of lethargic indifference, and a state of suspended, if you will, kind of physical powers. Why do anything? And even the word whatever seems to be a whimper, a kind of response to this rising sense of there's no way out of this and it's not going to get fixed and we don't have the means to fix it. So there's a soulish kind of cry going on the form of, sometimes in the form of indifference, or at least the temptation to indifference, because to care is to feel more pain. So why wouldn't I anesthetize myself against hopelessness by not caring? And I would argue that this sense of helplessness and powerlessness is not irrational. It's not an irrational response. Rather, it is a logical and continuing response that has cycled from my generation, beginning seeds in my generation, leading right down through the present generation. In a sense, it's really interesting. It is poignantly similar to the cry of the 19th century romantic temperament that forms the dark, haunting, this is a quote, a dark, haunting, tremorous reaction to and rejection of what someone has called the methodological, insert, technological industrialization of the human body and soul. And the terror of this is that it's happening at a time in an intellectual history when a reasonable and acceptable way of safeguarding or even recovering the cultural and philosophical means by which to construct the foundations, to keep the foundations, to rebuild the foundations for substantive resistance to these failures has been abandoned. The foundations are gone and the darkness is very dark. That's why we need Gutenberg College. Because if we don't have places that keep the language alive, we just have to. That's not an option. I was going to show a little clip from a film, but I think I'll show it tomorrow because we're at the end of our time. And thank you very much.